Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and really pleased to have Liz Freemuth back with us. She provides concierge horticultural services around the country. She's based right here in Wisconsin, but she works a lot of different places, and her business is called The Garden Hose. So it's great to have Liz back. And one of the things we're going to talk about is transplants, getting them out of your garden, into your garden, from out of your house or wherever it is. And we'll take, obviously, any question you have relating to the garden, but maybe start with transplant with Liz, and you can join in. Whatever your question, the number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Liz, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me in. Love it. Always love it.
By the way, thank you for bringing me a jar of your quince jam. Much appreciated.
Oh, people are going to get sick and tired of watching me walk around with a bag of jam.
Do you grow quince?
Yes, I do. I do. And in fact, when I get done here today, I'm headed over to, unintentional plug, to Jung's to see if they have any bare root quince trees left. I need to put another one in. Where I put my quince tree to start with was sunny. It's now getting shadier, and so I need to get something else started.
Is it, I mean, are they running out of bare root stock already?
I don't know. I get worried.
Because those are the best way to do it, bare root.
And especially if you're antsy to get outside right now, the bare roots have been sitting over winter. They've been taken care of with their humidity, et cetera, and they're ready to go. If they're out and available for sale, then they're ready to go and get put into the yard. And so just follow the instructions. Whoever, wherever you get them from or however they are stored, they will dictate to you what you need to do to that bare root before you put it in the ground.
It's the best way to go, for mm-hmm. sure. But you don't want to wait around till June.
No.
You're not going to find any.
You're not going to find anything, and it's best to get those in the ground now. And that's, you know, when we start talking about getting things into the garden, into the landscape, you want to work with that plant and how it works best for how it is right now before you put it into the ground. So something that has been out of the ground for the winter, stored as bare root, you know, you're going to moisturize that, you know, put it in water, et cetera, whatever the producer calls for. But that's ready to go in the ground now because it's been under cold treatment. So, you know, something in your yard that you're going to divide and transplant now, you can do that. Excuse me. You can do that because those are the conditions it's under. Now, if you've had something in the house all winter and now you want to put that outside,
that's a different story, a different kettle of fish.
That is, you got it. It's a completely different matter. So, and I'm sure we'll get some questions on that, but how do you do that? You have to make it comfortable out in that environment. So, number one is you have to know what plant it is that you're moving outside. And if it's a plant that really comes from kind of tropical roots, you are not going to want to move that outside until temperatures are up above 50. And I mean air temps, not soil temps, but air temps. And that means at night, too. So you're talking about an extended period of time to get those moved back outside. Now, and that's if you want to put them in the ground. If you're going to move them in and out, you can start to do that when the days are decent and you're just going to move it back and forth in and out of the house. Now, if you have 20, that's a task. So
yes,
you're going to want to wait. You're going to want to wait.
Well, actually, Pat and Little Shoot has something about putting a plant outside, I believe. Let's go there, if I'm not mistaken. Pat, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I have about a dozen amaryllis that bloomed around Christmas, mm-hmm. and I cut the stalks off, but then I had someone house-sitting, and they cut the leaves off as well.
Ah.
And I want to put them outside for the summer, bring them back, put them in the fridge mm-hmm. for next year.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure, now that the leaves are cut off, if that's going to be okay.
Yeah, it should be fine. Have you been doing this in other years? Is this a task you're familiar with?
Well, not really. Well, okay. I had a few last year, and I put them on for the summer, brought them back in, put them in the fridge. but no, I'd say no, not really.
Okay. So when you did that and you brought them back out for the holidays, did they bloom for you or did you just get leaves on them?
One bloomed and the rest were only leaves.
Okay. When they don't reflower, there are a couple of things that you want to watch out for. One is they may need some nutrition, that they don't have enough oomph in their systems to actually produce, get enough carbohydrates down into that bulb to produce a bud bloom in there. And so they will produce leaves, but they often won't do the bloom buds. And excuse me, it can be a fertility issue, but the other thing that can happen, and this is with any type of a bulb that you're going to refrigerate, is if you put it into your kitchen refrigerator where there are apples, carrots, etc., that they are going to naturally produce ethylene, those apples and carrots. Ethylene is an abortive, and it will actually abort that bloom bud on the inside of the bulb when it's in that enclosed space with it. So often what is recommended is that you use a refrigerator, you know, this is Wisconsin, let's be honest, most of us, if we have a garage, have a beer refrigerator in our garage. That's where you want that to go. You want those bulbs to go into a spot that doesn't have any fruit or vegetable that, excuse me, is going to give off any ethylene as it kind of sits. And, you know, really it's kind of it happens naturally as those fruits sit and in theory decompose. You know, as fruit and veggies will do, that's that phase before we get to the moldy stuff we take out of our refrigerators. But that will have something to do with whether they produce bloom buds or not. The other thing is the timing on it. You have to have an extended period of time for any bulbs that you're going to refrigerate over winter. They need X amount of weeks. And amaryllis, off the top of my head, I don't know what that is. I'm going to guess with the size of that it's going to be between 13 and 18 weeks of cold. So if you don't have enough cold, you're also not going to get that bloom bud to actually develop and produce a bloom for you.
So 3 months.
Really, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of after you're done with it around Christmas time or Thanksgiving, whenever you had it out and going, you need to get that into the fridge and get cold treatment on it. Now, I would double check my weeks on that because that's just pulling out of the gray material. But
yeah.
It really does follow with the size of the corm, the bulb, et cetera, whatever underground storage bottom that you're talking about with a plant. So it's a little bit less. You want to at least get 6 to 8 weeks on most of the smaller ones. It goes up dramatically as soon as you get a little bit of size on them. So that might be one of the problems, that they didn't develop blooms. But in moving that outside, amaryllis is a tropical. So you're not going to want to put that out and expect it to do well until we don't have frost warnings. So you're looking at May, you know, for us, and as you move further north down in the southern part of the state, we're looking at about the 17th of May is our usual last hard frost date. So that's what you really want to look for to then start moving those tender things outside.
Pat, does that help?
Well, one more question. I'm going to repot them and before I put them out, like you said, after frost, but what kind of fertilizer should I use then for them?
I would use a bulb fertilizer on those. And if you're going to move them outside, I would do, you know, right now, if they're not producing a lot of leaves and they're in a state of semi-dormancy, I would wait until about March, April or so to add some fertilizer. And you can just use a bulb fertilizer. That would work just fine. And you don't want to over-fertilize, and you also don't want to oversize the pot on an amaryllis. So if you're going to repot it and put it into something bigger, you really only want an inch or two around the outside of that bulb. That's what you're looking for pot size. So they like to be a little tighter. They like to have a pot that's pretty tight around their mass.
You know, there's always the temptation, and I've done it myself. I've used too big a pot.
Yeah, and it slows them down.
It's mm-hmm. Why? Why does it do that?
Well, think about you laying in your big old bed. You know, do you want to get up and get going? No. No. And some of these plants are the same way. You put them in a nice, comfy spot. They're just going to kind of hang out and enjoy themselves. And it's just some plants, we know, they're like people. Some like a tight space. Some like
a
really a lot of space.
Stress in their life, maybe.
Maybe. But that's just what they like.
I remember one of the Hort guys saying, when we were talking about trees that weren't producing, he said, well, I'd take a baseball bat out there and I hit them a few times with a baseball bat and put a little stress on them, and then they flower.
And then they pay attention. That poor tree. We plant people do some weird stuff to try and get things to grow. Controlling nature takes all forms. I can respect it's his tree. He can do what he wants to do. What that does, if you're forcing a plant to produce blooms or fruit or something like that via stress, that plant is sitting there going, oh, God, I'm going to die. I have to reproduce. And so that's why often when they're under a lot of stress, you'll see a heavy fruit and or flower production.
Liz Freemuth, our guest, taking a look at, obviously, all kinds of things in the garden here with her. And you can join in as well with your questions. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Several emails already. Bonnie emailed. She's talking about spring cleanup, and she's concerned about the beneficial insects that are, you know, surviving mm-hmm. the winter. And when can she start cleanup in the spring to avoid killing those beneficials? She does like to burn her debris when it's, mm-hmm. when it's, you know, she's raking it up. But what's the rule here? And it would vary depending on where you are in the state.
It does. And so for me, you know, especially because I'm out and about quite a bit in different growing areas, the biggest thing to watch for is not necessarily a date on the calendar, but, you know, if you're out in your garden, you're going to notice when those insects start becoming active. Once you see insect activity, then you can go ahead and do your spring cleanup, because we know that then they're emerging from their winter homes. And that to me is the kicker. When I see activity, and you're going to want to watch for bee, wasp, ant, you know, things like that that are going to be out and moving around. When you start to see that, then you can go ahead and do your cleanup.
Vicky and Millador emailed us, can you hand cut out Canada goldenrod plant by plant, two or three times per year for a couple of years and kill it? She's a very small garden, but used to have other prairie plants, plus her asparagus are getting crowded out by the Canada goldenrod plant. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want to kill the rest of the plants, but she just wonders, you know, can you just hand cut them and keep doing it?
Yes, and you know, that I happened to be in the car when you had Neil DeBole on. And,
yes.
And he did talk about that. And I've used it myself in large stands. You want to wait until about the middle of summer and then you start cutting it off. And within a couple of years, you should gain some control on it. And yes, you can do it, especially in a small area. Go for it. You can pull it up. Canada goldenrod actually pulls fairly easily, but you do have to make sure that you're on top of that over and over and over again. So maybe a combination, those that don't want to pull out easily, you cut off and do that a few times and then get rid of them. You know, we did a fairly, I want to say it was maybe about a quarter of an acre, and just mowed it off. It took a brush cutter out and mowed it off a couple of times and managed to get some decent control. It's something you have to stay on top of because they are thugs. They are garden thugs.
And I just learned from Jill that Erin Presley just confirmed with us that she'll be on Garden Talk next Friday. Mm. And, of course, the Saturday replay. And we'll start talking about garden cleanup practices mm-hmm. for that. Just saw Erin's parents the other night and in Wausau. And
wonderful.
Had a great time at the those talks that I'm doing around the state are going to be just barrels of fun. And just as an aside here, a big thanks to everybody who showed up at the Veninga Center in Wausau. We had so much fun. It was just a blast.
I am so glad you're getting to do a tour. I think that is so wonderful.
Yeah, and I'll be in, and there's still tickets, I'm sure, for the other place. I'll be in Green Bay, and I'll be in Eau Claire.
Oh, you think? They're probably all sold out.
Green Bay, Eau Claire, Madison at the Barrymore.
Wonderful.
I'm going to have to travel to the Barrymore. I'm going to have to travel. It's going to take me a good 4 minutes.
Oh, are you going to be able to handle that? Are you going to need overnight accommodations for that?
Anyway, by the way, that's all at, where do we go for that? WPR.org/presents. And all the, you need to ticket, it's free, but you need to ticket because the Wausau one sold out. So
well,
the next ones will too.
I don't know if you managed to look out the door when you were on at Garden Talk. Did you look out the door? The line that was waiting to get in, it was amazingly long.
Yeah.
Amazingly long, which is wonderful. A wonderful testament to you and how much you've given to everybody.
It was funny because at noon that day, Jill gets up and says, if you want to go, and I said to Jill, why are you telling people to leave? She says, because there's a whole pile of people out that want to come in. So I said, oh, okay.
Oh, the line was way out to the doors. Yeah, it was to the entrance doors. Oh, yeah.
It made for a fun time.
I think it's wonderful.
Well, let's turn our attention to peace lilies for a minute because mm-hmm. Marilyn emailed us about them. She has one that's over 25 years old, one nice. That's 7 years old. The older one stays droopy, and she thinned it, but still it's droopy. The younger one is starting to do the same darn thing. They're in the south window that has some shade from trees.
Mm. I tend to worry when houseplants start to droop, especially if they're plants that you've had for a while, because that means that you've done something right all these years and all of a sudden something is not right. And so to me, I look at the roots for that. And you may want to send a sample in to Brian's lab, the PDDC, Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic. You may want to send a sample in and have him test for root rot.
And you can tell if it's bad without even having to send a sample.
Oh, you can, but I respect his knowledge. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. One of the telltale things is you can pull it off and you can take a look at the roots. And if the roots are looking moldy or brown and yucky and bleh, then you probably have a rot issue in the soil. Now, you can do a couple of different things. Is often the treatment for root rot, you have to be a professional in order to get the products for that. So it's difficult for a homeowner to get any kind of root rot treatment. And so what I have found in those cases is that you can actually, and different plants will tolerate this differently, but you can knock all the soil off, wash them, you know, get some clean, sanitized water on them. So you want to use, you know, either boil some water and cool it, something like that. And clean those off, go to a different pot completely, and new soil.
New soil, for
new
sure.
New soil. And, you know, what I do is I cut off roots that don't look good. And so it's, but if you do that, anytime you're cutting into diseased tissue, you don't want to use that pruner's knife, scissors, whatever it is, on another part of that plant without sanitizing it. So Lysol spray or dipping it in a heavy-duty alcohol, all of that. Check Brian's website. He's got all of the disinfesting information on there. But I would do that and see how you do. You know, take a small root, send it in to Brian, see if that's what you're working with. But if you want to start playing around, see if you can't fix it, go ahead and do that.
But do that after every cut. I mean, it is kind of a pain in the butt, to be perfectly honest, to do that. But that's what you have to do. And then when you're done, don't forget to take some clean water and rinse off the scissors or whatever you're mm-hmm. using, because otherwise, I have learned through experience that
Rust-O-Matic.
rust right out when you're using those corrosives on your your utensils.
Absolutely. And that's where tool oil comes in really, really handy.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have a small container of even 3-in-1 oil on hand, you should, because that's something, it's a little metal can. And
oh, I love 3-in-1 oil.
Yeah. And you can pop that into a small bag with a rag, and you can take it out while you're working. And that way, as soon as you're done and you've disinfested throughout your process, et cetera, you've rinsed it off, then you go ahead and you oil them up kind of nice.
Cindy wonders, is it okay to toss an amaryllis after blooming and calling it a day? She feels guilty tossing.
No.
Yet doesn't have the time or space to nurture them during the summer. And thank you for addressing garden guilt, Cindy says.
I don't do garden guilt. Neither should you. You're A-okay to call it done. Or what you even might want to do to transfer that guilt to somebody else is to gift them the bulb and say, you had really good luck with it. Maybe even give them a picture of what the flower looks like, and maybe that will entice them to take over your task. But otherwise, no guilt, none whatsoever. When we buy them up here, it isn't so that we now have a garden plant. There's just those of us who are possessed that we can't give it up until the ghost is flying around. That's it. No guilt, none whatsoever. They are your plants. Do what you'd like.
Ellie in Madison emailed us, what do you know about bridge grafting? We'll test your knowledge here. Have some apple and pear trees.
I'm not good on that at all.
Bunny damage they're hoping to save. Well, the damage, we can talk about damage, mm-hmm, and whether or not something can be saved. And now is now the time of the year to graft, and you don't do any grafting.
I don't do grafting. So that is outside of my wheelhouse. What I would say is I would check.
Yeah,
trying
where
to
do you go?
Think. You know, there's a lot of commercial places. Yeah, almost anybody, any nursery who is doing production is going to be doing reproduction via grafting, almost all of them. If they're buying their plants in pots and bringing them in, they still may have somebody there. So my first thing would be to go to the local garden center, the one you use all the time, and ask them if they have anybody who's knowledgeable on grafting. Oftentimes, bridge grafting, I'm not good on. One of my sons does an awful lot of fruit grafting, and mm-hmm, so he gets hardy rootstock and grafts onto that and is very successful with it. And he doesn't put a lot of time into it, so get your basics down. Go online.
There's again, a really good book on grafting, and I can't remember the name of the author. Darn it.
And, you know, it's not a difficult thing to do. It's just not something I've ever gotten into. But yeah, a lot of nurseries do have their people who are fantastic on grafting. Now, if you're talking layering, that I can do, I mean, you know, essentially that's...
Now, what's layering?
Layering to me, well... Okay, not in the grafting world.
Yeah.
To me, when I look at a branch that's fallen underneath the mulch and develops roots on that, to me, that's a layering.
Okay.
You know, but this, somebody who is an actual production grafter may call that something else. But for me, you know, if you can do that, if it's something that's close enough to the ground and you can bury it, and it will start producing roots, then you cut to the plant side, to the mother plant side of that branch, dig it out nicely, plant it, and you should be good to go. So with apple trees, that's a little bit more difficult to do, obviously. But you want to, it's my understanding, that you do want to get that rootstock now, and you want to have those ends cut off of new tissue. So either last year's, you don't want brown anything on the cutting that you're using to graft to your rootstock. So you want that new tender growth. You don't want last year's growth. So to me, that's you wait just a little bit. If it wasn't cut last fall and you're not buying cuttings, then you want to wait until you've got something that looks like nice growth on it.
Andy in Eau Claire has an email for us, but before we do that, I'm looking over here and I'm seeing, oh, we've got open lines. You can join in and we'll get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I have so much fun talking with you, Liz, that I forget what I'm supposed to be doing.
We have to do our business, right?
I haven't had enough experience, I guess. I don't know. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Liz Freemuth. Her horticultural business is called The Garden Hoe, and she works a lot in Wisconsin, of course, but she'll go all over the country and does to help folks with their gardens. Questions, join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. I'll just check out Monday. Jeff Robbins is doing a little producing for us on Monday, and we've got four topics. We'll look
at,
yeah, it's all food related. We're going to look at medically tailored meals. We're going to find out what the new foods are at the Brewer Games this year. We're going to take a look at the latest in technology used by restaurants. And finally, we'll talk to the author of a new book. It's an interesting book. I've started reading it. I'll have it done by Monday. But it's the new rules of dining out. And I thought, what are the new rules of dining out? Actually, it's pretty interesting read.
Interesting.
I've read the first part of it. And so we'll talk with all those people on Monday. But right now, what's your garden question? Sonia in La Crosse, what do you have on your mind?
First off, I'd like to say, Larry, I'm dreading your retirement, but I hope it's a long, happy one.
Thank you very much.
And so, my question is, I have a Lottie's Love shrub rose that started budding out, you know, a good month ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now the leaves are really forming on it. And I haven't pruned it back for a couple years. Can I still prune it, or should I just leave that growth going? It's like on every single stem.
No, if you have not pruned it back, I don't think I would do a hard prune on the entire thing, because and this year is really an oddball year for us. I mean, if you've, I actually had one of my spring flowering viburnums partially flower last fall. It flowered in November, and I had one of the forsythia flower in November. That right now it doesn't have any, neither one of those have any bloom buds on them. And so normally what I would say is I can tell you exactly what to do with that, but this year I'm not quite so sure. And the same thing with a shrub rose, the fact that the leaves are out already and developing, it will slow that regrowth from the root because it's already the plant, the base of the plant, the system of the plant, is already sending nutrients up to all of those branches. Otherwise, you wouldn't be seeing the leaves emerge. So the system is up and running. And oftentimes, I like to prune before that because then you are sending all of that energy from the plant to the new growth, where now your plant is going to have to split. It's going to have to go some to new growth, and it will continue to go some to old growth. Now, depending on what phase that's in and how strong that system of the plant is, it's going to determine how much regrowth you get, how quickly. And so to me, what I would do is take out maybe about a third of it, prune it back, do about a third this year, a third next year, a third the year after, and really only because I don't know what this year is going to bring for a lot of the shrubby stuff that we've got. But you should be fine. You know, and if it's a really tough, well-growing shrubby rose, you should be able to cut it off and have it come back beautifully in a normal year. It's just this is not that normal. Of course, I don't know if we're going to have any normal ones anymore.
Yeah,
so
who knows?
You know, so I'm a little cautious to say hack that baby off and see what happens just because I don't want you to kill it.
Yeah, makes good sense. Sonia, good luck and thanks so much for calling. It's kind of the same rule that we use for lilac.
Mm-hmm.
When you want to, your lilac's not producing, do that third thing.
Right, right. Yeah. And you're kind of hedging your bets with that. You know, there are some instances where I will just be completely and totally brutal cut things off. You know, a foot, 18 inches, just cut them off. Whatever happens, happens. And I will do that, though, in my own yard and not in someone else's yard, because you really, we don't know. We really often don't know what a plant is going to do. So if I'm going to go to extremes, I'm going to do that in my own yard first and see what happens.
Let's, and again, Sonia, thank you. Let's turn to Barb in Stockbridge. Barb in Stockbridge, what's on your mind?
Hi, I have a question about my bougainvillea plant, house plant.
Mm-hmm.
I've had it for probably 15 years, and it's only bloomed once. Any suggestions?
Okay, bougainvillea do beautifully in warm, I mean, it's a tropical plant. So we're looking at warm, needs warmth, needs humidity. It, does it stay in the house 12 months out of the year?
Yes.
Okay. And do you fertilize it?
Not very often. Hi, that's another question. How often should I do that?
It depends on the fertilizer that you're going to use. How big of a plant, how big of a pot and a plant are we talking about?
I would say the pot is probably 10, 12 inches,
mm-hmm.
and the plant is easily 2.5 feet wide.
Okay. And is this one that you're training to kind of crawl on stuff, or do you cut it and it stays sort of at that 2 foot by 2 foot kind of spot?
I kind of train the vines and turn them into each other.
Mm-hmm.
So
a bit
and
of.
I'll cut back the dead or the real woody stem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you get a lot of regrowth after you cut those woody stems?
Not really.
Okay. I'm thinking it, my brain is going to, when I see them in an environment where they can live 12 months out of the year, they actually will be pretty brutal with those things and take, you know, hedge clippers and everything else to them, because you go to environments where they're out 12 months out of the year and they are hedges. They are just hedges. And, you know, wonderfully so. I mean, the colors are absolutely fantastic. And it makes, you know, makes me wish that we could grow them here just for the color alone. But my suggestion would be to really take a look at the interior of that plant and see if you've got old wood in there that is not producing anything. And you kind of have to get in there, you know, get your beverage of choice, sit down, put it on a table, sit down with your pruners and your disinfectant, because in case you run into something, you want to make sure you're ready to disinfect your tools. But then get the dead wood out as much as possible. And if there is some younger growth there, I would suggest that you start pruning that back a little bit. You may want to even look at if it's something that you're pruning to kind of grow into itself, you might even want to take that a step further and really cut those vines back and encourage them to grow out rather than up. And you may get a few more blooms that way. But I think fertility is going to be huge. Humidity is a huge thing for any of the tropical plants. And so, you know, fertilize and go and look for, go to your local garden center and or big box, whatever it is that you use, and get fertilizer for tropical plants. It will be there in the house plant area. And so follow the directions on that and fertilize. You do have to, anytime something is in a pot, you do have to fertilize fairly often. When you're in a greenhouse setting, even, you know, when it's growing season, they're fertilizing every third watering. And so you're looking at an awful lot of fertility that may be needed for that plant. And I'm not sure, I'd have to take a look at the roots on that, but you might want to slip the pot off of those roots, turn it on its side and slip the pot off and see if you need to cut back some of those roots. If they are wrapping around and around the pot, you may want to cut some of those off and rejuvenate the plant a little bit.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's a good idea.
To me, it sounds like, you know, it's a plant with some age And so now it's like, let's get back to basics here and say, what does it need? Well, it's going to need fertilizer. It's going to need to be trimmed. It may need a new pot. You know, maybe cutting the roots would be enough and putting a little new soil in and popping it back in. But I think just with a little bit of care, it should be okay.
On the fertilizer, what's the NPK? I wondered if it was higher phosphorus than nitrogen.
You know, anytime you're looking at flower production, you're going to go less on the
nitrogen.
The N. Yeah, definitely less on the N. And because this is a potted plant, I don't worry about what the phosphorus and the potassium levels are so much. You know, if it was outside, you know, we do want to pay attention to that so we're not putting extra phosphorus
outside.
But if this is an inside plant, I'm not that worried about it. But yeah, definitely something a little lower on the N.
Yeah. Barb, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Dave in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I purchased 3 bare root red buds. They're zone 5. They're the ones with the colored leaves all year long. And I was told to soak them for 48 hours in Garden Rich Root and Grow Root Stimulator and Plant Starter. It's a 410-3. Mm-hmm. Soak them in there. I think it's 3 tablespoons per gallon of water. And then I'm wondering, how do I plant them? And after they're planted, should I use mill organite on them once a year, kind of spread it around? And last question is seeds. Will they reproduce?
You know, it depends. I'll hit that last one first. Will they reproduce? Don't know. It depends on the cultivar that you have. And I, you know, without that, I can't tell you whether they will or whether they won't. As far as what to do, putting it into the ground, you want to make sure that you've got a really nice hole for those bare root plants to go in. So not like what I would normally do, because I'm terrible. I stress stuff out in my own yard to see how they're going to react. I often will just cut the size of the pot, take it out, pop it in the ground, and see what happens. And so that's me pulling dead plants out of the yard, looking to see how far did those roots wrap around in that hole, how far did they reach out into that kind of semi-compacted soil. With bare root, you want to give them every single advantage. And so you dig the $10 hole for the 10-cent plant. That's really exponentially what you should be looking at. You want to make sure that the turf is off of that area and you keep it off of the root zone area of that bare root to actually not have that turf compete for nutrients with bare root. It is going to have to develop a root system. It is going to have to produce branches, leaves, flowers, etc. So you may want to fertilize periodically, but I will tell you before you do that, send a soil sample up and get it tested, because we don't know what your fertility is. So getting something on that root as it is soaking and before you put it into the ground, fantastic. I don't think that red buds really need to be babied that much. They do tend to like a little bit lower pH than what we have, but they're in some of the areas. But if you're up, you know, if you've got any kind of sand, usually they're just fine. But I would just say loosen the soil up nice. Make sure it's got a good mix of organic matter in it. You don't want to over compost in the hole, but you might want to add a little bit of compost. And then don't do anything until after you have a test done and you give it a good season to actually get itself developed. As otherwise, fertilizer can stress it out and create too fast of growth on it, and that will stress the system out.
And as you say, you want a $10 hole. You don't want a kind of a looking like a post hole.
No,
dug.
You do not.
You want
yep.
it spread out mm-hmm. more like a dish, a big platter or something like
yep.
that. And then get those roots kind of mm-hmm. aiming out instead of around.
Right. And if you have clay soil, you definitely want to make sure that you rough up the edges of
yeah.
that hole.
Yes.
So you, because what you're doing is creating pathways for those roots to go into. And you can go on YouTube, you can go anywhere and watch roots grow underground. And you can see as soon as they hit any kind of an impediment to growth, they're going to go another way. They're going to try and work their way around it. So what you don't want to do is create a basin. You don't want to create a container in the ground, put a plant in and expect it's going to reach out. So, it's all soil dependent, it's plant dependent.
Yeah.
But if you give it the best shot, then you're doing what you can do.
Dave, good luck. Thank
yeah.
you very much for calling. Liz Freemuth, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Just a quick mention, if you tree questions, Paul Segan's going to be back for the last 30 minutes of the show to talk, zero in a bit on tree diseases and insects, but we'll take in your tree questions then. Other plants, though, Liz Freemuth, well, she could help with trees, too. But
we defer to the experts, yeah.
She can help you with your gardening questions, and I hope you joined in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And wanted to go to Andy in Eau Claire. He sees a lot of videos, people transplanting their tomatoes into their gardens, and they take it right out of the pot and put it into the ground. Shouldn't they give the root ball a little rub to loosen up the roots? Andy always does that, and it bothers him they don't do that in the videos. Frankly, I do that, too. I them up.
Yeah, and it depends on the plant. Tomatoes don't mind being roughed up when you put them in the ground.
Yeah.
There are some that you don't touch the roots or they up and die on you. But tomatoes, definitely. And, really, you can find a lot of good research out there with burying them super, super deep. So, yeah, just taking them out and popping them in. Do I do that? Yeah, it depends on how intense the system of the roots is in the pot. If it's really, really thick, then definitely I loosen them up. If it's kind of a new growth and there's some soil showing, then I don't, because I don't consider those roots sturdy enough to take the beating of kind of roughing them up.
Dave in Appleton, I had a question earlier. I don't think we got to all of his answers, so let's go back to Dave. Dave, hi.
What did I miss, Dave?
Hi. I'm sorry. I apologize. Yeah, these red buds are zone 5. Will they do okay in our zone 4? And also with using the 4-10-3 root and grow plant starter, should I use the 3 tablespoons per gallon and then soak the roots in there for 48 hours before planting? And can I pour that liquid over the top after they're planted?
Okay, so I'm going to go with the last one first again. Yes, you can. Use the recommendation, whatever the grower told you to use. That is what I would use as far as measurements in there. And definitely you can pour that right into, after you get it planted, pour it over the top, and it should be just fine. And as far as will it grow, I'm not so sure. This goes to our inconsistent weather again. And, they may do okay if they're in a slightly protected spot. I haven't tested, again, don't know the cultivar, so I don't know how far up or what your microclimate is in your yard. If you have, there are some yards, that I go to that I love calycanthus. That is Carolina sweet shrub. Love calycanthus. I've been growing it for 15 years. I've been bringing it up from down south, and that made for some really interesting airline travel here and there. But I have brought them, and I've worked with them for 15 years. In my yard, I can get them to be, especially certain cultivars, I can get them to be about waist high on my short frame. And yet I put the same plant into a client's place closer to Lake Michigan, and that thing will get to be 8 feet tall.
Ooh,
and so
cool.
It's just that their climate It's a little bit more protected, so it gets to be more of its native height than it does in my yard where it's not protected, and it just kind of keeps to a certain height. So it really depends on your microclimate, and I would say when you go to put it in the ground, because you're pushing that zone, see if you can't locate a spot that is going to accept the mature height, width, et cetera, of that plant, and also maybe give a little bit of protection. And then let us know if it actually lives through three winters.
Yeah, it'd be fun to know for sure. Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. David in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hello, Liz. Larry, congrats. I'm not sure if this is the right question for this team, but I think it is. My question is, I have two perennial gardens in my front yard, I'm continuing on the path of the other callers when it comes to fertilization, how to keep things with nutrients. I've been taking care of this property for some time. Do you ever resoil? How often do you want to ask me to put fertilizer down? It's been pretty healthy year after year. Or do I just leave it alone?
When you say resoil, are you talking about digging everything up and adding new soil or just adding soil around the existing plants?
Right. So
the second one? Okay.
So I was just in the soil. You know, we have dry seasons, we have wet mm-hmm. seasons, and the soil health seems okay, but I'm not mm-hmm. a professional in that space. But I don't know if you ever suggest, you know, to put a top layer of soil and let the nutrients soak in, or
if it's something that is performing well and you are happy with how things are, I would say always get a soil test at least every 5 to 10 years in an established bed, just to make sure that you're on the right track. And the UW Soil Labs, I don't know what the address is, but if you put that in a search engine and find out UW Soil Labs, it'll pull up the website where you can submit and get information. But knowing where your baseline is will help you determine what is going on, what isn't going on. For clients, I don't add fertilizer, number one, because I'm not licensed to, and I'm not going to be licensed to do that. And so I don't put fertilizer down. Do I recommend fertilizer here and there? Yes. There are certain symptoms that you can see in growth of trees and some of the plants where it is definitely, you can definitely see that there are nutrients lacking. But that is an on-site look. That's something that I watch for clients throughout time. So I notice that and I can actually do something productive. But then I pass that off to somebody who is licensed to do it. And that's just part of the commercial world that I respect their expertise. So gotcha on that one. If you are dividing those plants every 3 to 4 years and keeping them healthy so that they aren't thugging each other out, then really adding compost may be just enough for you.
Yeah.
And rather than think about putting soil down, you might take a look at good quality compost and get it from a reputable compost producer or make your own. And mm-hmm. and you can certainly top dress and work that in, you know, just take a little hand rake and work that in. And that may be enough for you. But without knowing what the baseline is, I can't really give a 100% yeah, go fertilize, because we can definitely do way too much fertilizer, way too much.
Way too much. And if you call, if you go online to the UW Plant and Soil Analysis, mm-hmm. Soil and Plant Analysis Lab, and then tell them what you're growing in that area too.
Right. And you may even want to wait until they start coming up this year
yeah.
so that you can include some pictures for them of areas that might be of concern, because the visual symptoms are going to give them a good idea of what they're looking at also.
Good perennial garden. I had a garden, a gardener say his definition of a perennial was First year, possibly. Second year, probably not. Oh, man. Liz Freeman will be with us for another 30 minutes here. I was going to say 30 years, but it'll be 30 minutes.
Who knows?
To answer your questions, and we've got several emails from Amy and Victor and Victoria. We'll get to those and your question as well. So stay with us. We'll be back right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller. My friends are listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Liz Freemuth, concierge horticultural services expert. She does it all over the country with her business, The Garden Hoe. It's great to have her back with us. Always enjoy talking with her. And we have lots of callers online. Denise in Madison has a question. Let's go there first. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Larry. My question is it ever the pot that's the problem? Not the person planting, nor the plant itself.
I love the fact that you are looking at where to point that finger. Awesome. You are my kind of gardener. Yes, actually, it can be the pot's problem, especially if you had something growing in it that had root rot issues. And you have to disinfect those containers. And if it's a plastic pot, disinfecting happens at roughly about 140 to 165 degrees, which melts plastic. So the research out there, you cannot get rid of the pathogens in plastic pots with bleach or any other kind of disinfectant. For some strange reason, it just kind of hangs out. The pores in the plastic are not conducive to shedding themselves even under disinfecting to get rid of those pathogens. So, yeah, definitely it can be the pot. And in that case, I would say if it's something that you're growing inside, go to a clay or a ceramic pot that can either be heat disinfected, you know, clay pot without any painted finish on it, can go into the oven. And Brian has on his Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic website, he has got great information on the temperature and how long to do that, et cetera. So either that or a 10% bleach solution that you soak those pots in, or there are other ways of disinfecting something that has got a finish on it. Plastic, not so much. So yeah, the answer is definitely. And I like the fact that you looked outside of it's all me. Because yeah. It's not always all us as gardeners.
No. Yeah. And pot size, as we've talked about earlier,
definitely.
Is the other part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go, Denise. Thank you very much for calling. Bob in Stoughton, we'll go to you now. Hi, Bob.
Sure. Hi, Larry. I want to put an endorsement on for the bare roots. Trees. I have planted lots of them, and they have all survived and wonderfully. And my own experience is, if you plant, my neighbor plants them, you know, the potted ones or the bald and burlap one, and in 5 years, my bare root one catches up to it.
Oh yeah, yep.
Yeah, because the roots are so strangulated in the pots. Now, the other thing I wanted to add is you were very careful, very precise in telling them to oversize the hole and to spread the roots. But if the soil is heavy, you need to also break that soil, powderize it really finely, so that you can kind of layer that around those roots and not just dump it in the hole and push all those roots down.
Yeah, good point. And, you know, when we talk about loosening the soil and potentially adding compost, it is really site specific. If it is clay soil that you're pulverizing, that often can create issues of compaction where the roots may not take it. So it definitely, your point is well taken, and it's a wonderful point that people do need to look at. Because what you want underground is you want a good mix of air pockets, soil, and water. And so if you skew that with either too much water or too big of air pockets or no air pockets at all or no fertility, then your stool, your three-legged stool, is not going to stand up well. So, yeah, definitely, it's a wonderful point. Thank you for bringing it up.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate the call. By the way, you can join in, too. The number to call with your question, 800-642-1234. I'll get you on pretty quickly. Bob in Sun Prairie has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. I have a question about a young maple tree that I planted about 3 years ago. And last year, it developed a problem called, I believe they called it maple gall,
mm-hmm.
which affected the tree quite drastically. And it appeared like about 50% of the tree was actually, it looked dead last year. I didn't go in and trim that dead stuff out because I got varying opinions. Some people said, well, wait a year. Some of those branches may come back. So that's what I'm doing. And the other thing they told me was these bugs that were creating that problem, that I couldn't spray them during the summer. They said it won't do any good, but they said in the dormant season you can spray 7 onto the tree to get rid of them. And I'm just wondering if now would still be a good time of the year before it leaves out to do that?
Did you send a sample or a picture or anything like that into the insect lab?
I didn't. I got my information from the company that I bought the trees from, which was a nursery up in New London, Wisconsin.
Okay. Mm. Questions that I have for you. Were these galls on the leaves only?
Yeah, they were like little pimples on the bottom side of the...
Yep. So generally, I look at those and say, aren't they cute? And that's about as much as I will do. Because anytime you've got leaf galls, that is generally caused by a tiny wasp or, you know, there's a handful of critters that are going to cause those galls. And what those galls are is where the larvae are growing, where the eggs are laid and the larvae are growing on the inside of that. If you cut one open during, you know, during the time when they're looking really fresh, like they just started popping, you cut one of those open, you can usually see a little bit of activity on the inside. That typically do not kill a tree. What may happen is you will get leaves that fall, or they don't look good because if the infestation or the eggs that were laid on there that then caused those galls, if they're injected into it, depends on the insect. If it is really a heavy, heavy infestation, then the leaves will get all sucked dry. And if it's later in the season, they may not re-leaf, but that doesn't mean the branches are dead, because that tree is going to continue to photosynthesize through those branches and through the leaves that are left on there. And that's really where you're going to get this year's development, you know, that continued to take nutrients in, it continued to take the sun in, it continued to take the water in, the whole thing. But it didn't have enough oomph, or it didn't have enough time to push new leaves out. And that really will depend on the time of the year that those things hit. Do I worry about them? No. No, I do not. It's really a cosmetic issue for the most part. You may see with a lot of these insect populations, you may see a few years where they're really, really bad, and then it may drop off. So it's kind of a roller coaster with it. And oftentimes you'll see a heavy infestation for a year, 2 years, and then it'll drop off and it's not going to be as noticeable at all. 7 has got, I want to address that specifically, because 7 has got a very short activity period. So if you go out there and you spray that now and there's no insect activity and you don't really even know what insect you're treating for, It's not a good idea.
No.
It's not a good idea. And so I would say I don't anticipate that this has killed your maple tree, not by a long shot. If it did kill the maple tree, then take it back and show, you know, dig it up, depending on how big it is, and take it back and say, look, you know, this isn't a problem that should not have killed the tree. Either that or take some pictures and, you know, go in and talk to them. Most people will stand behind their materials. But I would not go out and treat, number one, because I don't know exactly what critter it is. And number two, the effective period, it's going to run out before those insects become active. So it's wasted time and money on your part.
There you go, Bob. And Paul Sagan is probably going to address questions similar to this
right.
in the last half hour of the show, I'm guessing, Bob, so you can stay listening. But that was good advice. I think you gave very good advice there. Thank you for calling, Bob. Lisa in Madison, your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Can you recommend Primocane raspberry without thorns for Wisconsin?
Ooh, without thorns, huh?
Thornless raspberries.
Ooh,
wouldn't we all love those?
Yeah, we would. We would. What part of the state are you in?
Madison.
Mm-hmm. Man, oh man. No, I can't, quite honestly. Not off the top of my head. What I would do is I would go to UW Extension website and take a look at their growing raspberries in Wisconsin. Take a look at that. And they do have recommendations in there on fruit, shrubs, et cetera, that are going to grow fine here. But that is one that typically is not as hardy as our thorned ones. And so where I'm not.
That's the problem.
Yeah. There might be a yellow one out there that is thornless-ish. No, I'm sorry. I don't have a good answer for you on that one. That would be my recommendation. Check out growing raspberries. Either that or hit one of our fruit growers. Hit one of the good garden centers in town. And, you know, there's Jung's, there's Bruce Company. There's a ton of really good companies out there that go to the garden center and dig around. But I would do a little bit of homework first.
Yeah, and then I'd go to that publication. If you just type in UW-Madison plant
growing
raspberries
in
Wisconsin, you're going to get some good information there.
Yep.
For
and
sure.
it's going to be well-tested. It isn't going to be anecdotal only.
Right. Thank you for that question. Carrie in Reedsburg will go to you now. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Thank you both so much for taking my call and for all the really good information. My daughter and I do some container gardening, and we're trying to start some seeds this year, but we're not having very good luck. We've got some flowers.
Welcome to gardening. Yes.
Yeah. I just don't think we have the environment for it. But what do we need to get seeds to start?
Okay, what have you tried so far that has been unsuccessful for you?
Well, we have them in the starter containers, mm-hmm. and we have some flowers, and then we have some tomatoes, mm-hmm. and we keep them wet. We mist them every day with water, and we have little heating mats.
Mm-hmm.
underneath them to try to keep them warmer between 70 and 80,
mm-hmm.
and that's about what we've been doing.
Okay.
You have light over them?
Well, we started with them in the window, but it's an east-facing window. That's the only one we have. But then we put them in the dark because I read something somewhere that they needed dark. So we're not sure about that part.
No, that's not good.
Yeah. So let's do a few basics. And tomatoes are usually pretty easy if you follow a couple of things. What you have to look out for on any seeds that you're starting inside is you want that very top edge of the soil to not be wet 100% of the time. Otherwise, what can happen is you can actually create an environment that the stems start to rot off. And then you will see them kind of bend over and flop, and then they're gone. So you need airflow. You need light. You need heat for germination. But once those plants start growing, then you don't really necessarily need a lot of heat on the base. But light is really important. And a window may not be enough for you. It will be enough to germinate some seeds, to get them started. But then windows, I'm going to back that up and say windows, even bad windows, old windows, are going to filter about 85% of the light rays. And so you just go in, if you have an old lamp or, especially like a desk lamp, something like that that points downward, and get yourself a good grow bulb. And then make sure that you check to see how much light per day each one of those plants need, and put a timer on it, and then make sure that that light is there. You are also going to need airflow, so that's get a fan on it. And then you move those around. What that fan does is it encourages that plant to develop sturdier stem structure so that it's less likely to fall prey to damping off, which is, too wet, and then it flops over. So, and each one of the plants is going to have, especially from seed, they're going to have a specific temperature that they germinate best at. So whatever plants that you're going to do, look up, to pop it into, this is a good thing to do. I don't know how old your daughter is, but it's a great thing to do starting early on. And that's pop it into a search engine and say, tomato germination temperature, and or zinnia seed germination temperature. Sure. And that's what you're going to want to have that heat mat set at, and then it will tell you also how long you need to do that for. So depending on what it is that you're growing, everything has a different germination temperature. Like this weekend, I'm planting potatoes. My soil temperature is 40, it's above 40. So potatoes are going in. And that's because potatoes will grow at 40 degrees. Now you put a bean seed out there at 40 degrees and it's going to rot. So Everything and doing really following the temperatures is going to give you a better shot at it. And misting definitely is good. Just you want that top level to dry out a little bit here and there.
And I don't know when you started your tomato plants, but if you started them a couple of weeks back, you probably were starting a little early.
A little early, yeah.
6 to 8 weeks is about right on. Actually, zinnias too.
Same thing. Yeah.
Same thing. About 6 to 8 weeks, so that they're coming. They're ready to go after the first frost.
Yep. And again,
or after the last frost.
After the last frost. And tomatoes especially, anything, because it's a tropical plant, that if you put it out when night temperatures are going to be falling and you don't cover them, then they can actually, they'll produce a hormone that does not encourage them to grow. And so you have a tougher time getting them to actually produce throughout the year if they're hit with cold early on. So while they'll survive under 50, are they going to thrive and are they going to produce? No. So it's a lot of those little tiny tips that will get you success, definitely.
Yeah, tomatoes and peppers are another one. You don't want to put them out in the... Yeah. And I wait until the end of May, even in the first week of June.
Right. And, starting some of those is fantastic, but failure is also part of that fantastic, because you're going to learn from that and you're going to try again. And thank goodness you started early, because now you can keep going.
Yeah,
and
you're still in good shape.
Yeah, you've got plenty of time. So, yeah, perfect.
And I've mentioned this in the past on the show, but the first time I ever did my tomatoes indoors, the seeds, and grew these wonderful plants and stuck them right outside. And the next morning, it got cold overnight, and they were completely white.
Yes, they were done.
Completely lost all their chlorophyll.
They were done. And, and there are ways that you can cheat that a little bit by using either milk jugs with the bottoms cut off and the lids off, so that if you save those and have them ready, if you do want to put your stuff out early that doesn't like the cold, you can pop your little pretend greenhouse over the top or a row cover or something like that and give them a bit of protection.
Yeah, and you're not going to get any peppers if you get that plant in the ground too early, which
No. You know,
they won't flower. You won't get a flower.
To me, I look at where are these plants native? Because where they're native is...
ain't here.
It ain't here. And so we're really forcing the issue. And we have to respect that. We want to put them out early, but they may not want to go out early.
So there you go, Carrie. Good luck. I hope you have good success. Let us know.
I do too.
Give a call back in a month and let's see how things went.
And you know, props to you for giving it a go. And don't be discouraged. Just keep at it. You get enough tips and you'll get it right.
Patty emailed us. She has two 15-year-old African violets given by her kids when they were in grade school. Here we are 15 years later. They're still going, but now they have long, floppy necks. How do you take care of this so they become more upright?
Okay. Questions on that one that she's not on the phone. So I'm going to throw these out there for you to look at. And that's, have they been divided at all? If not, you may want to do that. They may be getting a little bit too close together. When I see floppy stems, foliage, leaves, et cetera, on African violets, I think about powdery mildew. And that you can kind of see, it'll look a little bit like frosting. If you look early stages, I'm watching powdery mildew on my sweet potato starts right now. And it has kind of, under a magnifying glass, it has kind of a little crystalline sort of look to it. And so you can kind of see this is what you're dealing with. And again, I'm gonna reference Brian. If you go to Brian's Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, he does have some African violet suggestions on there, but there also is a home kind of recipe that you can use for powdery mildew. But increasing the airflow around those may be enough to take care of it. And what I would do is I would divide those out, especially if they haven't been done, and then you'll have lots of babies. So if you do lose one, you aren't going to lose all of those that have got good memories for you.
Can't have them in my house. The cat, Coco, would just eat them all up.
Some houses just don't grow. You know, that African violets do not do well. I had lovely ones from my grandmother. A house that we lived in, they all went belly up. And it was not an area, no matter where I put them, it wasn't an area conducive to African violet thriving. But good luck with that.
Victor wonders, is it okay to plant a potted forsythia lilac and Korean dwarf lilacs now? He bought these a week ago from Walmart, and they were staged outside, so he assumes they're ready to be planted in early spring.
I would say, yeah. If they were staged outside, I would say go for it. If it was something that came from inside a greenhouse to outside, I would say you want to acclimate it over a couple of weeks before you try and put it in the ground. But if it was outside, nah, go for it. And after the amount of rain we had, nice time.
Yeah,
nice time to do it.
And it's a nice time to end it for us, for you and for me today. Liz, is always a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for the quince jam, by the way. And thanks for being with us. We'll look forward to your next visit.
My pleasure.
Liz Freemuth, her business is The Garden Hoe. And you go online to her website. You type in The Garden Hoe and it'll pop up, and she's got some good information on it right now for you. Great to have her along. Taking a look at trees next. And your tree's health with Paul Segan. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Your trees we're turning our attention to. They're starting to wake up, and that means it's time to watch out for problems with them. And we'll be talking about dealing with things like pests and diseases and maybe some winter damage, how to keep invasives out of your planting area. Well, that's a lot for a half hour. Paul Segan is with us, DNR Forest Health Specialist in northwest Wisconsin. And I hope you'll join in with your questions as we move along. Paul Segan, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Larry. Yes, there is never a shortage of good topics to talk about when we're talking about getting ready for the spring and summer planting season here with trees.
What do you think in the way of pests and diseases to watch out for this year? How does the DNR know when they might be a problem or what might be a problem?
Yeah, it seems like for all the different tree species we have, there's at least one or several pests or diseases that afflict them. And so we keep an eye on pretty much everything, and we receive reports all year round, primarily during the growing season. But what we can do here is we can look over the last, in this case, we'll say about 5 years, and know that we were in a drought cycle over these last 5 years, and that led to a lot of specific types of incidents on trees, mostly insect defoliators. We saw a real surge of defoliators over the last few years as trees became more and more stressed from drought, and as the growing season conditions and lack of moisture and warmer temperatures really favored the population development of some of our common defoliators, things like spruce budworm, spongy moth, oak leaf rollers, some of those things that can really be subject to these population upticks and outbreaks when we have warmer weather and dry weather. But we've kind of seen an easing of that in the last year. We've seen 2025 be somewhat more, a little bit wetter overall, and a little bit of an easing of that drought. And so through watching that weather trend and through looking at the observations, the field notes, and seeing kind of a reduction in those reports of defoliation and some of the pest population surveys that we do, it seems that most of the defoliators are going to be kind of quieter this year in 2026. That being said, it doesn't mean that the trees are off the hook, because it's often said by some of the veteran forest health specialists that as we have wetter years, we tend to see more disease incidents come onto the scene because of the favoring of and the microclimate created that favors the development of often fungal diseases. And so in that sense, we can look forward to with a prediction for somewhat of a wetter April and somewhat of a more neutral precipitation pattern going into early summer, some diseases might come back on the scene that we see somewhat commonly, but we might see an uptick in them. And I've got a couple of names here of some things to watch out for. I think that on our spruce trees, particularly Colorado blue spruce, but also some of the white spruce and black spruce, we might see more rhizosphere and needle casts. These are They're a variety of diseases, but rhizosphere is the biggest one of the needle cast diseases in terms of frequency that we see. And this leads to infections in early spring as those new shoots are starting to develop, usually around mid-May through about mid-June. And we get fungal infection on these needles that causes them to slowly turn brown and then cast or fall off the tree, hence the name the needle cast. Some other ones we can expect possibly are, and this is on hardwoods, is anthracnose. Anthracnose is pretty common when we get kind of cooler, rainier types of spring weather, especially with a few frosts thrown in there. If we get late spring frost, we tend to see a fungal disease on hardwoods, maples, oaks, called anthracnose, which can lead to a kind of a melting-like appearance or necrotic dead blotches on the leaves. And oftentimes the leaves, if they're severely infected, they'll fall off and the tree will have to refoliate. And then the other one I have noted here is a potential uptick in armillaria root disease. As we've had the drought stress for the last few years and as we've had spongy moth defoliation, armillaria root disease generally can be a benign type of root disease that's ever so common across the landscape, but it can become more aggressive as trees have accumulated stress over multiple years. And so it can kill them, can be a contributing factor. So I think we might see more armillaria root disease kind of continuing its march through the root systems of stressed oaks as a result of that drought and spongy moth.
So a few things to worry about here with Paul Segan. John in Mount Horeb has a different kind of question, I think. Let's go there. John, hi.
Yes, thank you. I have a question about moving white pine trees. We have probably 8 or 10 white pine trees, anywhere from 6 to 12 feet tall, and they're in a place that we'd rather not have them, and we have a preferred place. So the question is, could those be successfully moved, you know, at that size this time of the year, or should there be a better time of the year? And, we'd have a professional mover come in with a big truck with a spade on the back and such. And I don't know if it matters at all, but we have kind of rocky, sandy soil as well. So just curious about moving those white pines.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great question, John, and it can be done. I should ask, what is the diameter approximately on these trees at about the breast height?
Oh, I would say probably 2 to 3 inches.
Okay, yeah, that's good. I think these trees could be successfully moved if the care given to them in the new place they become planted is up to standard. And so I would probably wait until we get into the early part of May. You could do it in latter part of April, but I would let things warm up a little bit with the soil so that where they end up getting planted is a little bit more hospitable and the roots can start to take and develop. But yeah, I would make sure that prior to the transplanting, these trees are well watered, so they're in a good moisture state so that there's some uptake of that soil moisture by the root system. And then when you do eventually transplant them, you're going to want to be very mindful of the care once they get into the new site. That's going to involve, of course, mulching. It's going to involve some fertilization using an organic fertilizer. Larry and I have talked about our favorite. We really like fish emulsion. That is a great one, and it's less likely to burn or cause fertilization stress to the tree. And then also making sure that the site it gets planted in is generally a suitable site. It's not too rocky. Any obstructions that would impede the root development are sort of addressed or removed at the time of planting. But yeah, I've talked to a few people this spring who have done this and they've had success with it. And with those professional tree spades, it can work well if you take care when you do it.
Yeah, all good points. John, good luck with that. Appreciate your call. Stephen in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, I'm actually calling. I live in Madison Block on the north side of town. My wife and I bought 32 arborvitaes in our outlet to outline our property. While I was digging a hole, it was about 18, 20 inches of topsoil that got down to clay. We have them all planted, and the problem is we receive a lot of brown spots on the end of the arborvitaes. Mm-hmm. What can we do to prevent that from happening, or how can we fix that so we don't have to replace them?
Stephen, when did you plant those?
Late July, about mid-July to middle of August last year.
Okay.
Okay, so these trees, Stephen, are still under some transplant stress. You know, usually we're seeing a window of transplant stress that may last a couple to a few years as these trees are starting to try to regrow the roots that were lost when there was some root pruning to transplant them. But even in the absence of this transplant stress, we could see winter browning or the development of some diseases in these in the foliage of the arborvitae. I think you might be dealing with some winter burn. It's pretty common on conifers. For sure, cedar or arborvitae are very prone to it. And what we end up having is that during the cold winter with really drying and cold winds, we can lose a lot of moisture in the foliage. That's hard to replenish when the roots are kind of stuck in the soil around frozen soil. So they're not getting the replenishment. So what you might be seeing is that effect of browning and dead tissue. What I would recommend is to not go too intense with any pruning until we get into probably the end of May, mid to end of May. Once you start to see the new shoots develop, you're going to want to look and make sure that you prune back eventually anything that died or isn't leafing out, isn't expanding out. But I would give it time because you don't want to add additional stress by pruning out living tissue. The other quick check you could do, you could look at some of the buds. Oftentimes what we see is that even though the foliage can turn brown, even though that might be dead, buds are often hardier. They can withstand colder temperatures than the tender leaf tissue. So you could scratch a couple buds around the trees and look for any kind of green. If you're still seeing green tissue around the buds, that is a sign that it's too early to know if these are going to die or if they're going to make it and leaf out. But I think in the future, if this site is by a road, that's a consideration. Salt spray, we've seen quite a bit of it this year. There are some protective measures with salt spray, which are similar to reducing cold, drying winds that can cause winter burn, putting a little bit of burlap around the young trees that where it's suitable to put it up, and you can kind of stand it up with some wood dowels. That's something you can do. And then also generally avoiding areas really close to the road where you might get more salt drift. Again, something we're seeing more of this particular March and April.
Yeah. And Steve planted those in July. And one of the things that I think is important, well, for any trees of that nature, is to make sure they are watered right up until ground freezes up on newly planted trees. Mm-hmm. I mean, and newly planted to me would be, if you planted them in July, I'd be making sure that there was plenty of water, well watered as it goes into to freezing.
Absolutely. That July period is really high sun and high temperature. And so it's particularly stressful for a tree. So really want to match that and ameliorate that stress with ample watering. And like you said, Larry, generally right until the ground freezes, we want to keep water on those trees. And that actually going into winter and dormancy with a good water status from watering can prevent a lot of the other things we see on trees, like frost cracks and sun scald that develop later on in the winter when we get really cold snaps.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Stephen, thank you. John in Port Wing, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I called in previously about storm damage on a white pine or a white oak that I planted about 20 years ago. And after we had some thawing, I got a chance to look at it again, and the whole top has been broken out by heavy snow and ice, and it's split at the top. Am I going to be able to recover, to salvage that tree? And I just hate to lose it.
How big is the tree?
20 years ago.
Oh, it's 20 years? Oh, okay.
Yeah. John, about how much of that crown has snapped off or has been compromised, if you were to give a percentage of that kind of round peak part of the tree?
Probably 10%, maybe 15, 20%, somewhere between 10 and 20%. And it's split down. How far down would I want to cut it if I'm going to try to salvage it?
Yeah, we have seen quite a few frost cracks develop this winter, so it's a topic on my mind. I think to address it, you're probably going to want to cut all the way down to where the crack ends on the base part of the crown, the lower portion of the crown. But ideally, you're going to want that cut to be very close to where there's some other lateral limb. What you don't want to do is leave a stub behind. When you make that cut, you want it pretty close to where there's another limb that can eventually start to grow and maybe start to sort of grow upward as the sunlight promotes that upward growth. With a case like this, I would say it may be a good idea to consult a certified arborist to get the best outcome, maybe to consult them or even hire them to do the job, as they're going to know where to prune this in probably the most appropriate location. If you decide to go about it on your own, the DNR's Urban Forestry Program has a number. They've got two or three publications that have kind of a diagram of how to prune trees and how to prune trees correctly to avoid issues and correct issues like cracks that develop. So those resources on the Wisconsin DNR's Urban Forestry Program website are good places to check if you're going to do this yourself, John.
Probably should be doing it sooner than later, too.
Yes, I think that's a good point. Larry, good point. We have the oak wilt issue. So that we'll throw a plug in for oak wilt. Yes, because we're dealing with an oak here, we really want to wrap up any pruning, wounding, or injury cutting, such as cutting to oaks, before April, well, before April, depending on where you are in the state.
April 15th, and, I think they say, is the latest or something.
Yeah, April 15th in northern Wisconsin. So we have reached the high-risk period in some parts of Wisconsin, down in about the southern third of Wisconsin at this point, and we're going to be reaching it pretty soon in other parts of the state too. So I would say, if you're going to do that work, one thing you could do is apply a pruning sealant to it, John. That's going to protect that surface from introduction of oak wilt. Generally, the white oaks are a little bit more resistant to oak wilt infection, but still, just to be safe, I would probably either wait to do it or do it quick and use some pruning sealer.
Yeah, there you go, John. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, as we talk trees with Paul Segan, DNR Forest Health Specialist, works out of Northwest Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Talking trees with Paul Segan, I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in with your tree questions. Michael emailed us. He has some volunteer bur oaks that he'd like to transplant. When's a good time to do that in South Central Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think he can start making his plans right now. I think as we get into about mid-April, latter part of April, it is going to be a good time as the soil starts to warm up in that area to do these transplants. One of the things with transplanting that I often think about, and I've seen some recent work from some of the forestry folks that do a lot of transplants, not so much transplanting, but planting, is that care of root systems is really important. And sometimes when we prune off too much of the root system, we can really lead to poor performance in the tree. It's interesting that a lot of people, and I myself, still get into the thought that a larger tree to transplant is better. But the truth is that the smaller the tree is when we transplant it, it often has a better chance of success, usually because we don't have to prune so much of the root system off.
Yeah.
That root system is really vital to the tree's survival and success. And to the extent we can minimize that by sometimes choosing smaller, if you got smaller bur oak to transplant, those maybe are your priority. So you're not having to prune so much of the root system off, so we can get establishment sooner and avoid any kind of turbulent weather events that the tree might otherwise have to sustain.
Susan in Elk Mound emailed us. She has a three 8-year-old black ice plum trees that produced beautifully for several years. They've now contracted some kind of fungal growth on the fruit that is brown and mummifies the plums. Any ways to treat for that?
Oh, that is some kind of fruit disease. I would have to double check. That one I would almost recommend getting a diagnosis from the plant disease diagnostic clinic. Former guest mentioned Brian Huddleston at the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. He does a great job, and he does sample diagnosis. So what Susan could do is take some digital images or collect samples, if she's still got any, perhaps from last year, and send those into the diagnostic lab and get a diagnosis, and then from there determine what types of treatments might be appropriate. That one is a little bit out of my realm, so I'll have to defer to the lab for something like that.
Yeah, UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. If you type that in, you'll get all the information you need. Jerry in Kaukauna, what's on your mind?
I'm calling about root systems too. Can you cut some of the roots on an older established tree that you are just worried about roots pushing into the basement?
Yeah. Well, what kind of tree have you got there, Jerry?
It's a maple tree. I'm not sure of the exact species of it.
Okay. Well, it's a maple, so you got some shallow running roots.
Yeah. Maples love to send their roots out pretty much wherever they can. Jerry, how far away is the foundation from where the tree is growing?
The base to the basement, the base of the tree to the basement is 14 feet.
Okay, 14 feet. And about how wide would you say the crown of that tree is on its width, the crown width?
It's not over the edge of the basement, but,
It's getting close.
Getting close. Okay, so you know, some of those roots are going to be pretty important for the health of that tree. Maples are pretty hardy. They can handle some root damage for sure in construction projects. And they send out a lot of roots that are pretty prolific. My guess is that that probably wouldn't compromise the tree's health if you take some other measures to make sure the tree's otherwise healthy. Again, basic principles of mulching during that time after you cut roots, making sure you keep that tree watered within that drip zone around the crown area, especially during periods of dry weather. During the summer, it could be a good idea. But given how hardy maples are and how tough they are and how root prolific they are, I don't think it's going to be an issue. Whether or not you'll achieve your mission is questionable because, you know, those maple roots might just grow right back in the next couple of years. So it's often a battle with those types of trees with their roots.
Well, my dad planted a willow tree next to our home. And when we went to sell the home this last year, the first thing we had to do was fix the basement wall that was bulging in because the roots... It was about the same distance, Jerry.
Trees have quite the will to live and to survive.
Yeah, it was a little expensive process fixing that for sure. Patty in Windsor, your turn. Hi, Patty.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about arborvitaes again. I put in like 20 arborvitaes about the same time in July. I watered them really well. I deep watered them before winter. And that, like maybe half of them are very rusty orange, and I'm worried they're not going to make it. I'm just wondering how many years should I cover them with burlap to protect them? I have a really harsh north wind that comes in.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Are they near a road at all, Patty, where they could have been subject to salt
drift? No, they're not near a road at all. They're in my backyard.
And they're turning orange.
Yep, they're rusty.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I have to believe it was probably it was subject to those heavy doses of cold, dry wind, and probably and winter burn is probably what you're faced with. Again, as far as remedies, I'd wait and see what ends up growing here as they start to leaf out, and then prune back anything dead to where you start to see live tissue. As far as the burlap goes, I think as long as you can put burlap around it, I'd say around up to 4 or 5 feet would be a good idea to make sure by that point the tree's well established. Now, this burlap, you really don't want to keep it on during the growing season. You want to take it off, of course, so that that tree can maximize its photosynthesis and we don't get the stagnation of moist air, which can lead to development of some of the fungal diseases. But I would say up to 5 feet or probably at least a few years once they've become established to make sure they're just not getting inflicted with additional stress during the winter.
All right. There you go, Patty. Thanks for calling. Brent in Wausau. Hi, Brent.
Hi. I've got some eastern hemlocks that are growing into other trees and growing over the roof line and was just wondering if there's a best time of year and a best process for pruning those back.
Oh, yeah. Hemlock. One of my favorite, Brent. I've got some hemlocks in my yard and I'm thinking a little bit about the same. They're not big enough to need to be pruned yet, though, for structure. But generally, hemlock and a lot of our other trees are best pruned outside of the growing season. During the dormant period is a good time. That way the tree is not as prone to producing odors that might attract an insect or disease. It's a little less stressful to the physiology to prune during the winter. And before before additional growth occurs here in the spring is still a good time. So you could still get some of that pruning done now. With the hemlock, I think, you could defer to a certified arborist in terms of how to prune them. If they're large, of course, no ladders, no kind of sketchy access to the branches to prune them unless you're on the ground and using a long extension pole saw. But also, I'd recommend looking at that pruning guide from the Urban Forestry Program at DNR to see some of the diagrams on how to cut, where to cut. Those types of trees, because hemlocks are pretty tough. They can handle a decent amount of pruning, but we never want to prune more than about a third of the living tissue in any given year due to the stress that can cause on the tree. So I would say maybe. A couple of years to minimize the 1 year impact that could otherwise occur on the tree.
Oh, you broke up there, and we just missed your last couple of your last statements there, Paul.
Oh.
But I think we're done. Actually, we're out of time. Paul, it's been a pleasure. I'll be seeing you again before I retire. I'm pretty sure of that. Thank you.
I think so.
Thanks so much for being with us. Paul Segan, DNR Forest Health Specialist. Always great to have him stop by. And we'll have him for a longer time the next time he's on. I'm pretty sure. In fact, I know that to be the case. Great to have him with us. And thank you so much for listening. And big thanks to our team. We got Clara Neipert. We got Joel Patnaud, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. And, of course, I'm Larry Mueller. I really appreciate you listening in. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.